The next case of the morning is number 03-1863, the United States against Swanson. Mr. Tice.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Bill Tice. I represent Mr. Swanson. First of all, the good news for the court is that 2 days ago the government submitted a Rule 28 letter in which it conceded that the district court had used the wrong sentencing guideline book and should have used the 1998 book, and that this was not harmless error, and the government recommended that the case should be sent back for resentencing in the district court, and I assume the court has seen that letter. Obviously, though, there are other issues that remain.
We haven't received that letter.
I, for one, certainly never saw the letter.
Okay. I'm aware of the existence of the letter, and I'm aware of the position taken by the government. I don't think there's any question they want it sent back for resentencing. Am I correct?
Yes. Mr. Clark, would you obtain copies of that letter for Judge Rover and myself, please?
And if there's any problem, the clerk's office can certainly contact me, and I'd be happy to send over a copy of it.
They're here.
Okay. So hopefully, if you know about it, then it's here. So then the question is how to calculate the loss, and as to that issue, of course, the government is not conceding error, and as a matter of fact, in the same Rule 28 letter, it's cited for the court to use a recent case of this court, United States versus Sykes. And I'll talk about Sykes in a second. Let me just set the stage for talking about Sykes. In this case, the district court had before it a pre-sentence investigation which really just gave a number for the loss. Perhaps that number was based on some extensive submissions that the government made after the verdict, although it's not entirely clear how the PSI came up with that number. The defense objected to the amount of the loss and filed a fairly lengthy written objection to the $6 million figure. And the district court's position was, well, the jury's decided all of this. I don't need to calculate the loss.
You know, I need to ask you something in light of everything that, you know, that Judge Ripple and I were unaware of. But your reply brief stated that the government had not presented any evidence that Mr. Swanson's scheme extended past November of 2001. And that, in fact, they hadn't presented any evidence that extended past July 2001. I need to know this. Are you conceding that the scheme continued until 2001 but not through 2002?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
No.
The scheme that was as to which the government presented evidence ended long before 2001. Certainly the last execution of the scheme that the government attempted to prove was in 1998. Now, I know the government has the theory that there were other businesses that Mr. Swanson tried to start up and that they were fraudulent, and really some of that was disputed and some of it wasn't, because it really wasn't even part of the trial. It sort of was part of the post-trial submission that the government made. So we're not conceding that there was fraudulent activity.
And I do have one other question for you, because at sentencing, what Mr. Swanson argued was that the loss amounts were incorrect. But each time that the district court asked him to supply an alternative number for his loss, his lawyer stated zero, based on a claim of innocence. So Do you think that's sufficient showing to dispute the accuracy of the amount? I mean, zero vis-a-vis, you know, 54 million?
Well, it's generally a very uncompromising approach, and maybe at that stage of the proceedings, some lawyers would have been a little more willing to compromise. But his position, as I understand, and of course, I came in long afterwards.
We know that.
Was that
he would have never done that, Mr. Keith.
Well, I don't know what was available to him. So but his position was there was no fraud at all. It's true that we presented that position to the jury, and it's true that the jury seems to have rejected enough of that position to convict us on the counts on which we were convicted. But that doesn't mean that there was a loss in whatever amount the government wanted to present. And I would look at the other side of the coin, Your Honor. If the judge had said, you know, I sat here through this whole trial, and I heard the evidence, and it is my conclusion by a preponderance of the evidence that the amount of the loss was this, this, and this with the following components, we would have a very hard time trying to dislodge that type of a finding, because the judge would have done her job and made an independent determination as to what was the loss. But instead the judge said, oh, the jury's decided all of this. I don't need to decide it. It's $6 million. Well, the jury didn't decide all of that. The jury certainly didn't decide $6 million, and it's even questionable that the jury decided $2.4 million.
Isn't that a fair reading of that, though, that the judge just bought the government's case?
I don't think that that's a very precise way for a court to speak when the court has this sort of an obligation.
I can see your point on precision, but it's not a perfect world.
And I don't think that it's hyper-technical when there is this really vigorous litigation. And there was vigorous litigation below at the trial and after the trial and at the time of the sentencing. It's not hyper-technical to insist that the court say, in my independent role, I'm making the following findings. And if the judge wanted to buy the jury's findings, the most it could have bought was $2.4 million. The jury made no findings, even implicitly, that there was a $6 million loss. So that's a real problem. We're hoping that that's a problem that can be resolved properly once this case goes back, because it seems that it will go back. Obviously, that's your decision, but even the government's conceding it should go back. There are other questions that are very related with regard to restitution. I think there the record is even sloppier. We've got the problem with the forfeiture. I don't have the time to go into that. We'd rest on the briefs on that unless you have a question.
Realistically speaking, how much of the $54 million forfeiture could ever be recovered?
I don't know the answer to that. If it were a $54 million forfeiture against someone who all of his life had worked in a factory, you could almost say, who cares, it's academic. But Mr. Swanson, despite his reverses and despite his problems, is someone who, when he does get out of prison, does have the capacity and the history to make a fairly decent living. And a $54 million forfeiture verdict, if it's not the correct verdict, and we say it's not, would be a problem. And so in his case, it is important to get it right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodlow.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Sometime during your presentation, you could address the government's position on the forfeiture. I would appreciate it. I find it difficult to follow.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, with the court's permission, then I'll just start with the forfeiture issue and give you my views on that, and then see if there are any questions regarding it. Pardon me. The forfeiture grows out of basically the operation of the scheme. Our view in terms of preparing the proposal for our forfeiture order was to base it on the four money laundering counts because they provided a broader amount assessable against the defendant than to use another theory. Each of the money laundering counts, counts 14 through 17, incorporate the scheme to defraud. The breadth of the scheme in this particular case, as broken down and submitted by us in the post-conviction material, came out to $53 million. Two-thirds of that was from the Malta Clayton acquisition, that is, Countrymark's acquisition of a seed business in Mexico. And here's the rationale behind including that amount as a forfeiture amount. David Swanson, as the chief executive for the corporation, signed a document obligating the corporation to purchase this Mexican seed business on May 15, 1996. At a time when the board had not even been advised of the proposed acquisition. At that time, he obligated the corporation to pay $31 million to buy that Mexican seed business. In June, on June 5, at the first board meeting after he had signed the document, he then advised the board of what he thought was a good business prospect, that is, purchasing this Mexican seed business.
Buckeye, right?
I'm sorry?
Is that Buckeye?
That one is Malta Clayton, Your Honor.
Oh, that one was Malta Clayton, okay.
And at the June 5 board meeting, he told the board that other cooperatives would join in this venture, and the board's agreement was to go ahead and pursue it. It was to be a $5 million joint venture with other co-ops. The defendant then, at the next board meeting, approached the board about an additional $5 million because at that time they had not gotten any additional prospective joint ventures. So now the corporation's potential exposure is $10 million. At that time, he had already signed a purchase agreement. The agreement called for the purchase of the Mexican feed business through an entity which he owned and wholly controlled called Project Explorer Mark II Corporation. And that corporation was basically non-existent until the end. Well, it didn't exist until May 31 of that year. So it was created for him to buy the Mexican feed business. It had no existence. It had no capital. He's now at the point of $10 million. There are no joint venturers. Eventually, they get a Growmark out of Bloomington, Illinois, to join for an additional $10 million. But he's still short. Swanson, there, chief executive of the corporation, obligates the corporation to loan this entity he created to make the purchase another $15 million. So now the corporation's exposure is $25 million at a time when the board basically is only barely conversant with the fact that they are to make an acquisition which they believe is going to cost them about $10 million. So finally then, on August 5, the defendant obligates the corporation to basically fund the transaction. His corporation then, on his directive, sent $25 million to Bankers Trust in New York to a bank account in the name of this acquiring entity, which he had created, and the bank account had on him on the signature card. So he's got now $25 million from his corporation. He gets $10 million on that same day from Growmark in Bloomington, Illinois. He's got $35 million now in the acquisition fund. He uses $31 of that to actually buy the Mexican feed business. He's got a reservoir of $4 million left, or just a little less than $4 million. That kind of thing was the rationale for including the entire $35 million as part of the forfeiture because the corporate entity itself was a victim. The scheme was, in fact, producing that kind of reservoir of funds that led to the money laundering counts in 14 through 17, and even though those individual instances of transactions in 14 through 17 may not come up to $53 million, they clearly grow out of that kind of scheme.
But does the corporate entity lose $35 million?
It doesn't move it in this sense, Judge. They actually acquire a business. But basically, the defendant's action so weakened the corporation that within a short time after he was fired, the corporation collapsed. In fact, the testimony of the board secretary at the trial was that all that was left as of the time she was testifying was the fuel business. The rest of the corporation ceased to exist.
Now, what's your best case for the proposition that the district court can include all the money Country Mark spent in the acquisition of
Following along with that rationale for the forfeiture action, the calculations which counsel wants, you know, sometimes when you get another fresh approach.
I'm still having difficulty seeing how all of that's related to the money laundering charges that would justify your forfeiture to the government of that money. It seems to belong to the people who were defrauded, i.e. the people who own the company.
Let me see if I can answer a little bit further in that regard in terms of the money laundering. The scheme produced the $35 million. It went into one account in Bankers Trust. The defendant paid for at least the acquisition on August 5. He had $4 million left. He then on that same day had $4 million transferred from that account to another account at Bankers Trust, which he controlled. And then from there it was dribbled out into other accounts and then put it at his personal disposal.
So the remaining $4 million he, in effect, appropriated.
Well, actually, the corporation got two of it back. But he had $4 million there, and he took $2 million of it on that same day.
So does that bring us down to $32 million?
Well, Your Honor, my view there is this. The law says if it's involved in the transaction, and in this particular case, if you try and read that law as counsel is suggesting in his brief, you're going to almost always wind up with basically whatever the transaction was on a particular day. For example, did someone deposit some money or take some out? And I think the law is much broader than that. It is calculated to pick up, in fact, the breadth of the transaction, and in this particular case, $35 million in one transaction, and that scheme to defraud is incorporated in each one of the money laundering counts. In fact, then part of...
I mean, like when Country Mark acquires Buckeye, it acquires a legitimate operating entity, right?
It did, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, we know that he illegally skimmed some money off the top of that deal, but Country Mark actually received something of value in return for the money it invested, just like it did for this Mexican feed company. I mean, they get... $2 million, right?
Well, this court decided a case called Lauer, 148 Fed 3rd 766, and in that particular opinion, the panel held that at least for the calculation of loss, you are looking at the amount of money that was put at risk or exposed. And my view there is, certainly on behalf of Country Mark, for the forfeiture action, the amount exposed was $25 million. I think, by the way, with regard to the calculation of loss, the same thing. If we approached it, instead of just taking what I did there and submitted to the probation officer, that is a conservative approach of only what we could tabulate that had been lost by an individual. If you look at the potential loss calculations for this particular defendant are going to go much higher than $6.7 million. It's going to be more like $25 to $30 million. And he may not, in fact, like the result of our recalculation under Lauer.
You're saying it would be higher?
It would be higher. It would be $25 million. The amount that was exposed by the scheme. The board had never approved that request. This is the defendant only acting on his own to perpetrate a scheme. And under that theory, the exposure to the victim is, in fact, the total amount of money that he was not, in fact, properly authorized to expose, $25 million. The fact that they got something back as is indicated in the opinion here in Lauer. The fact that they actually got something back and they didn't lose the entire $25 million doesn't change that. I see my time has expired, but I'm willing to stay longer if there are additional questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodlow.
Thank you.
Mr. Tice, we're going to give you 2 extra minutes since we gave the government some extra time.
Okay, thank you.
That'll be a total of 3 minutes then.
Okay. I'm at a little bit of a loss to respond to counsel's analysis of Lauer, since that was a case that was not included in the briefing. But you don't need to read a case to see the problem with what counsel's talking about. The purchase of this Malda Clayton company was a real purchase of a real asset. Now, there was some whining and complaining at the sentencing hearing about how investments had gone sour, but this wasn't like someone buying racehorses or buying futures in gold mines in Estonia. This was a large, reputable, you know, some far-off place. And nothing against the...
Don't you start in on the Baltic States.
This was a large, reputable, well-established company, Malda Clayton, that was bought as a real investment. And no one ever said at the trial that there was anything flaky or dishonest or disreputable about the investment. The government's only claim was that Mr. Swanson was skimming excessive expenses off of that purchase. So to talk about a risk of loss or an intended loss of $25 to $30 million just is not right. It's not part of the government's theory of the case. It's not part of the evidence. In fact, it's contrary to the evidence. And so whatever Lauer says is probably neither here nor there. Listening to counsel talk about the forfeiture, I heard a very long and interesting recitation of the facts, but the most important fact is that there were counts of money laundering, and the amount of money that was laundered was $1.8 million. That should be the extent of the forfeiture, nothing more. Now, I know counsel has this theory that you can forfeit for the money that's involved in a money laundering scheme, but the forfeiture statute says nothing about money laundering schemes, and probably because there is no such offense as a money laundering scheme. You can have conspiracies to commit money laundering, but Mr. Swanson was never accused of that nor charged with that. And so this case is entirely unlike cases like this court's decision in Baker, where I've got a big pot of money. Some of it is legal, some of it's illegal. It's all my money. The government gets to forfeit it all if I've used the legal money to sort of cover up the illegal money. Here we've got the corporate employer having a big pot of legal money, which is spent legally as intended. The government proves that Mr. Swanson skimmed off $1.8 million. That's the extent of the forfeiture.
Am I correct that Mr. Swanson, if all remains as it is today, will be like 77 when he comes out?
You know, I'm not sure about his age.
He was born in 42.
Okay, so that would make him
64.
60, 61 or 62, depending on where.
72, yeah.
And the court gave him a sentence of 15 years.
Yeah.
And if there's a remand, and even if the law stays the same, that's going to knock some time off. And of course, it's our position that even more time should be knocked off on the loss calculation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.